In the quiet corridors of Darlington Hall, a story of profound human complexity unfolds through the meticulous observations of Stevens, a butler whose unwavering dedication to his profession masks deeper emotional currents. Kazuo Ishiguro's The Remains of the Day captivated readers and critics alike when it was published in 1989. Earning the prestigious Booker Prize and later inspiring the Academy Award-nominated film starring Anthony Hopkins and Emma Thompson. The novel's exploration of dignity, regret, and unspoken love resonates across cultures and generations, with figures from Barack Obama to Phoebe Waller-Bridge citing it as a personal favorite. Beyond its literary acclaim, the book's examination of blind loyalty and self-deception in pre-WW2 Britain offers a powerful lens through which to examine our own complicity in larger systems and our tendency to sacrifice personal fulfillment for professional ideals. Stevens, the aging butler of Darlington Hall, embarks on a motoring trip through the English countryside in the summer of 1956. This seemingly simple vacation marks his first substantial absence from the grand house in decades. The journey is ostensibly practical. His new American employer, Mr. Faraday, has encouraged him to take a break while he returns to the United States for 5 weeks. But beneath this surface explanation lies a more compelling motivation. A letter from Miss Kenton, the former housekeeper of Darlington Hall, hints at her unhappiness in marriage and awakens in Stevens the possibility of recruiting her back to resolve staffing issues at the house. The deeper we delve into Stevens' narration, however, the more we realize this journey represents something far more significant, a rare opportunity for reflection on a life spent in unwavering service to others. As Stevens navigates unfamiliar roads, he experiences a mixture of unease and exhilaration that mirrors his tentative steps toward self-examination. When a local man encourages him to climb a steep path for the best view in England, Stevens initially bristles at the suggestion that his age might prevent such exertion. Yet, upon reaching the summit, he's rewarded with a panorama that becomes a metaphor for his expanding perspective. The English countryside stretching toward the horizon, revealing both beauty and limitation. What strikes me most about Stevens' early reflections is how he equates the greatness of the English landscape with restraint rather than grandeur. Other countries may offer more spectacular scenery, he observes, but England's countryside possesses a calm, understated beauty that knows no need to shout its virtues. This assessment perfectly mirrors Stevens' own character, his pride and emotional restraint, his belief that true dignity lies in self-effacement, and his conviction that greatness requires no fanfare. The journey has barely begun, but already the physical landscape serves as a canvas upon which Stevens projects his most deeply held values. What constitutes a great butler? This question preoccupies Stevens throughout his journey, becoming the framework through which he evaluates his life's achievements. The Hayes Society, an exclusive organization of elite butlers that operated until the early 1930s, once declared that the most crucial criterion is that the applicant be possessed of a dignity in keeping with his position. Stevens embraces this definition wholeheartedly, seeing dignity as the essential quality that distinguishes truly great butlers like Mr. Marshall or Mr. Lane from merely competent ones. Unlike his colleague, Mr. Graham, who compared dignity to a woman's beauty, something one either naturally possessed or did not, Stevens believes dignity can be cultivated through self-discipline and experience. His father exemplifies this quality in Stevens' eyes, despite lacking refined speech or extensive knowledge. The story of a butler in India who calmly informed his employer about a tiger beneath the dining table before ensuring dinner with no discernible traces left of the recent occurrence represents the professional ideal to which both Stevens and his father aspired, unflappable composure in extraordinary circumstances. A particularly revealing anecdote involves Stevens' father confronting drunken gentlemen who made treacherous remarks about his employer. Without speaking a single word, the elder Stephen's imposing figure and dignified bearing silenced the men, demonstrating how true dignity could command respect without sacrificing restraint. What's fascinating about this story is how Stephen's treasures it not primarily for the defense of honor, but for the manner in which it was accomplished, the perfect maintenance of professional distance even while taking moral action. Yet there's a profound tension in Stephen's philosophy of dignity. While he claims it represents moral strength, his examples repeatedly show dignity as the suppression of personal feeling in service to one's employer. When his father serves the very general responsible for his other son's death in the Boer War, he does so with such perfect concealment of his feelings that the general leaves an unusually large tip. Stevens presents this as the pinnacle of professional achievement, the complete sublimation of personal grief and righteous anger in service to one's duties. But I can't help wondering, is this truly dignity, or is it a form of self-erasure that borders on the tragic? The arrival of Miss Kenton as housekeeper at Darlington Hall introduces a counterbalance to Stephen's rigid professionalism. From their first encounter, she challenges his carefully constructed world. Entering his pantry uninvited with flowers to brighten your parlor, she immediately notices the darkness of his private space despite the sunshine outside. When Stevens politely rebuffs her decorative efforts, explaining his preference for minimal distractions, we see the first clash between her natural warmth and his cultivated restraint. Their professional relationship is further tested when Miss Kenton begins noting errors in Stephen's father's work: a dustpan left in the entrance hall, silver with polish residue, ornamental Chinamen positioned incorrectly. Their confrontation in the corridor represents a pivotal moment, with Miss Kenton bluntly suggesting that his father's powers are now greatly diminished and describing the trembling hands and physical decline that Stevens refuses to acknowledge. This moment illuminates one of the novel's central tensions, Stephen's unwillingness to confront uncomfortable truths that might disrupt his carefully ordered worldview. What makes their dynamic so compelling is that Miss Kenton's challenges aren't merely professional, they're existential. She represents everything Stephen's has suppressed in himself: emotional honesty, spontaneity, and the courage to acknowledge difficult realities. Their interactions crackle with unacknowledged tension precisely because she threatens not just his professional authority, but his entire philosophy of life. When she insists on seeing what book he's reading and discovers it's a sentimental love story, she penetrates the barrier between his professional and private selves, a boundary he guards with almost religious devotion. The development of their relationship follows a pattern of advance and retreat, with Miss Kenton repeatedly attempting to draw Stevens into more personal connection and Stevens consistently reasserting professional distance. Yet beneath his narration, we sense a growing attachment that he cannot acknowledge even to himself. Their evening cocoa meetings, ostensibly established for professional communication, become a ritual that both rely upon, until Stevens abruptly terminates them when the emotional undercurrents become too threatening. Stevens' recollections of Lord Darlington reveal a complex portrait of a man whose good intentions led him down a morally questionable path. Now deceased and publicly disgraced, Darlington emerges in Stevens' memory as essentially shy and modest, a true English gentleman drawn into international affairs through a profound sense of moral duty rather than ego or ambition. Stevens insists that, contrary to recent nonsensical reports, his lordship was genuinely good-hearted, motivated by compassion rather than political naivety. The catalyst for Lord Darlington's political activism was his friendship with Herr Karl-Heinz Bremen, a German officer who visited regularly after World War I. Stevens observed with alarm Bremen's deterioration with each visit, his increasingly impoverished clothes, thinning frame, and haunted expression reflecting Germany's economic collapse under the punitive terms of the Versailles Treaty. After visiting Berlin himself, Lord Darlington returned deeply disturbed, declaring, "It does us great discredit to treat a defeated foe like this, a complete break with the traditions of this country." When news came that Herr Bremen had committed suicide on a train, Lord Darlington devoted himself to addressing Germany's crisis. By 1922, he and Sir David Cardinal had gathered an international alliance to organize an unofficial conference at Darlington Hall aimed at revising the harshest terms of the Versailles Treaty. Stevens recalls this period with pride, believing himself to be serving at the very fulcrum of great affairs, as distinguished visitors, including Lord Daniels, Professor Maynard Keynes, and H.G. Wells, gathered to discuss Europe's future. What's particularly striking about Stevens' account is how he separates the moral content of Lord Darlington's politics from his own professional responsibilities. Even when describing his lordship's brief but disturbing anti-Semitic period, during which Stevens was instructed to dismiss two Jewish housemaids, he maintains that a butler's duty is to execute his employer's wishes without question. Our professional duty is not to our own foibles and sentiments, but to the wishes of our employer, he tells an outraged Miss Kenton, suggesting that his lordship is better placed to judge the nature of Jewry in this complicated and treacherous world. This willful blindness becomes increasingly troubling as Lord Darlington's political activities evolve from humanitarian concern for Germany's suffering to dangerous appeasement of the Nazi regime. By the late 1930s, Darlington Hall is hosting Herr Ribbentrop, the German ambassador, and Lord Darlington is facilitating connections between Berlin and influential British citizens. When Mr. Cardinal, his godson, desperately tries to warn Stevens that Lord Darlington is being manipulated by the Nazis, Stevens maintains that he has every trust in his lordship's good judgment and refuses to engage with the political implications of his service. The International Conference at Darlington Hall in 1923 represents the pinnacle of Stevens' professional life and a turning point in European history. His preparations for this event reveal both his extraordinary competence and his single-minded dedication to service. Approaching the challenge as a general might prepare for battle, he devises special staff plans, analyzes weak points, creates contingency plans, and delivers a pep talk to the staff, telling them, "History could well be made under this roof." The conference brings together 18 distinguished gentlemen and two ladies, many with their secretaries, valets, and interpreters. The central drama revolves around M. DuPont, a French delegate whose support is crucial. As one participant remarks, the fate of Europe could actually hang on our ability to bring DuPont round. The American delegate, Mr. Lewis, complicates matters by attempting to influence M. DuPont against the conference's aims, suggesting that Lord Darlington is manipulating him by excluding him from important discussions. Amidst this high-stakes political maneuvering, Stevens faces personal tragedy when his father suffers a stroke and dies during the conference's final dinner. His response to this loss reveals the full extent of his professional dedication, or, viewed differently, his emotional repression. When informed of his father's death, Stevens maintains his composure, declining to go upstairs to see the body and asking Miss Kenton to close his father's eyes instead. "My father would have wished me to carry on," he explains, before returning immediately to serving port in the smoking room. This moment represents both the triumph and tragedy of Stevens' philosophy of dignity. On one hand, his ability to continue performing his duties flawlessly despite personal grief demonstrates extraordinary self-discipline. On the other hand, his inability to pause even briefly to honor his father's passing suggests a profound disconnection from his own humanity. When he later recalls this evening with a large sense of triumph, seeing it as proof that he had achieved the dignity to which he had always aspired, we're left wondering about the cost of such achievement. The conference itself ends with mixed results. M. DuPont ultimately announces his support for revising the Versailles Treaty, but condemns Mr. Lewis for abominable behavior in trying to undermine the proceedings. Lewis, visibly intoxicated, responds by dismissing the gathering as naive dreamers and amateur gentlemen meddling in affairs beyond their understanding. Lord Darlington counters with dignity, stating that what Lewis calls amateurism is what they prefer to call honor, earning enthusiastic applause from the guests. Beneath the political drama and professional challenges runs the novel's most poignant thread, the unacknowledged love between Stevens and Miss Kenton. Their relationship evolves through a series of missed opportunities and misunderstandings, culminating in a profound sense of loss that Stevens can barely articulate even to himself. The turning points in their relationship are subtle but devastating. When Miss Kenton enters Stevens' pantry and discovers him reading a romance novel, she penetrates the barrier between his professional and private selves. When she stands outside the summer house after their argument about the dismissed Jewish maids, her silhouette, outlined against the mist, represents a moment of connection that Stevens fails to grasp. When she announces her suitor's marriage proposal and Stevens responds with mere professional courtesy, the depth of their mutual disappointment is palpable, despite neither character fully expressing it. Perhaps the most haunting image in the novel is Stevens standing outside Miss Kenton's door, certain she is crying within, but unable to offer comfort. This moment, which he recalls years later with extraordinary vividness, encapsulates the tragedy of their relationship. Physical proximity combined with emotional distance, deep feeling rendered inexpressible by professional constraints and personal inhibition. When they finally meet again after decades apart, Miss Kenton, now Mrs. Ben, makes the novel's most heartbreaking confession. "I get to thinking about a life I may have had with you, Mr. Stevens." She admits to occasionally dwelling on what might have been before realizing her rightful place was with her husband. Stevens, devastated but still unable to express his own feelings, can only encourage her to look forward to happy years with her husband and grandchildren. What makes this love story so affecting is its restraint. Unlike conventional romances with passionate declarations and dramatic reunions, Ishiguro gives us a relationship defined by what remains unsaid. The depth of feeling emerges not through grand gestures, but through small details. Miss Kenton bringing flowers to brighten Stevens' pantry. Stevens remembering the precise way she held her head. Both of them recalling a shared moment watching his father pace before the summer house as though he hoped to find some precious jewel he had dropped there. As Stevens' journey nears its end, he confronts the cumulative weight of his life choices. Sitting on Weymouth Pier, he engages in conversation with another retired butler who notices his profession. In a rare moment of emotional honesty, Stevens confesses his feelings of inadequacy serving Mr. Faraday after giving his best years to Lord Darlington. "I've given what I had to give. I gave it all to Lord Darlington," he admits, his voice unexpectedly breaking. This confession leads to Stevens' most profound realization that while Lord Darlington made his own mistakes, Stevens himself failed to exercise moral agency in his life. At least he had the privilege of being able to say at the end of his life that he made his own mistakes, Stevens reflects. His lordship was a courageous man. He chose a certain path in life. It proved to be a misguided one, but there, he chose it. He can say that at least. As for myself, I cannot even claim that. You see, I trusted in his lordship's wisdom. The tragedy of Stephen's life lies not in having served a discredited employer, but in having abdicated responsibility for his own moral choices. By defining dignity solely as perfect service to his employer, he denied himself the dignity of independent judgment. By subordinating his personal feelings to professional duty, he sacrificed the possibility of authentic human connection with Miss Kenton. By refusing to acknowledge political realities, he became complicit in actions he might otherwise have questioned. Yet the novel ends not with despair, but with a modest hope for the remains of the day, the evening of Stephen's life. The elderly butler on the pier advises him to stop looking back and enjoy what time remains. As Stevens watches the pier lights come on to the crowd's delight, he contemplates this advice. Perhaps, then, there is something to his advice, that I should cease looking back so much and try to make the best of what remains of my day, he concludes. In his final resolution to practice bantering with renewed commitment to better serve Mr. Faraday, we see both the limitations of Stephen's character and his capacity for growth. He still frames his personal development in terms of professional service, yet his recognition that human warmth matters represents a significant evolution in his thinking. The novel leaves us with the sense that while Stevens may never fully overcome the habits of a lifetime, he has at least begun to question the philosophy that shaped his choices. Throughout the novel, Stevens proves himself an unreliable narrator, not through deliberate deception, but through self-protective blindness to uncomfortable truths. His recollections often contain contradictions that reveal more than he intends. When describing Miss Kenton's confrontation about his father's declining abilities, he suddenly questions whether she spoke so boldly at that early stage in their relationship, suggesting his memory has been colored by later events. When recounting Lord Darlington's anti-Semitic period, he minimizes its significance while simultaneously providing details that reveal its disturbing nature. This narrative technique brilliantly illustrates how memory serves not just as a record of the past, but as a tool for constructing a bearable version of it. Stephen's account of his life is shaped by his need to believe that his sacrifices were meaningful, that his employer was honorable, and that his professional dedication represented true dignity rather than misplaced loyalty. When facts threaten this narrative, he either reinterprets them or questions their accuracy. The most poignant example comes when Stevens reflects on turning points in his relationship with Miss Kenton. But then, I suppose, when with the benefit of hindsight one begins to search one's past for such turning points, one is apt to start seeing them everywhere, he observes. There was surely nothing to indicate at the time that such evidently small incidents would render whole dreams forever irredeemable. This insight reveals both his growing awareness of opportunities missed and his continued reluctance to fully confront the consequences of his choices. What makes Stephen's self-deception so moving is that we can see what he cannot, the full human cost of his professional philosophy. His narrative reveals a man who has subordinated his own humanity to an ideal of service that ultimately failed to provide the meaning he sought. Yet even as we recognize his blindness, we're invited to question our own capacity for self-deception, our own tendency to construct narratives that justify our choices and shield us from regret. As twilight falls on Weymouth Pier, Stevens contemplates what remains of his day, both literally, as evening approaches, and metaphorically, as he faces the final chapter of his life. This moment of reflection brings the novel's themes into sharp focus, suggesting that even after a lifetime of misplaced loyalty and missed opportunities, there remains the possibility of growth and connection. The strangers around Stevens on the pier demonstrate what he has missed: the easy human warmth of bantering, the ability to form connections without the barriers of professional distance. Observing their interactions, Stevens recognizes a skill he has neglected throughout his life, one that his new American employer values highly. His resolution to practice this skill represents a modest but significant step toward a more authentic existence. What gives the novel its lasting power is this delicate balance between acknowledging life's irretrievable losses and affirming the value of what remains. Stevens will never have the life he might have shared with Miss Kenton. He cannot reclaim the years spent in service to a discredited cause. He cannot fully overcome the habits of emotional restraint ingrained over decades. Yet, within these limitations, he can still choose greater authenticity, greater connection, greater awareness. The remains of the day thus becomes a metaphor not just for the evening of life, but for what persists after disillusionment, the possibility of finding meaning even after one's guiding principles have been called into question. Stephen's journey through the English countryside becomes a journey toward this modest but essential realization, that dignity lies not in perfect service to others' ideals, but in the courage to acknowledge one's own humanity, with all its imperfections and unfulfilled longings. In the fading light on Weymouth Pier, as Stevens resolves to make the best of what remains, we're left with a portrait of dignity more nuanced than the one he began with. Dignity not as the perfect suppression of feeling, but as the grace to acknowledge loss while still embracing life's remaining possibilities. It is this redefinition, rather than any dramatic transformation, that gives the novel its quiet power and enduring resonance.